New York, in Rockefeller Center and Grand Central Station. I asked myself, how can you offer something that New Yorkers don't already have? I thought the answer would be tri-tip. Pickerel emphasized a theme we'd heard before, in places as different as Holland and Eastport, and Sioux Falls and Duluth and Redlands, and that would recur through our travels to come. That was the power of local loyalties, local attachments, a sense of belonging, and rightness in being on a part of the earth you felt was home. Pickerel's own life, and the lives of many others we met in Winters, turned out to be such an example. Pickerel had been ready to move back to his original home of Montana by the 1990s, but I met the love of my life, who was from a larger town near Winters, and this is where she wanted to be. In the next generation, their own children couldn't wait to get to bigger cities after finishing high school in rural Winters. But, he said, they have come back to Winters. They're invested in the town. It's where they love. That's the best way to measure the sustainability of a town like ours, he said, when young people come back with education and experience and add a twist to what we are doing. The kids come back. They bring their A game. They see that there are possibilities here.
Bend, Oregon. It was inevitable, I suppose, that one of us would get sick sometime during our adventures. That fell to Jim, who was coming down with a frustrating, lingering flu when we hit Bend in the high desert of central Oregon. In an unanticipated way, his illness, which turned into some kind of persistent cough and infection, became a chance for us to explore Bend differently from how we explored most other towns. We kept reporting, but we also built in more downtime to do the sorts of things that Bend offers. Here is an odd combination of day-in-the-life activities that I won't even try to stitch together. Hotels, baseball, marijuana, traffic roundabouts, and public libraries. We were very lucky with our hotel, which mattered. I had learned a lot about hotels by the time we reached Bend, having stayed in dozens and dozens of them along our way. Most of our lodgings were utilitarian, but with exceptions, like in Bend, where the name Wall Street Suites, WSS, caught my eye. The WSS began as the Plaza Motel, a classic 1950s motel, featuring pull-in parking for your big old family Buick right up to the door of your room. Across the street from the then offices of the Bend Bulletin, still Bend's fine hometown daily, the motel was a favorite of visiting journalists. It was destiny, I thought, that we should end up there. I had time to learn the history of the motel, from its dark past as Felony Flats to its bankruptcy in 2010. Two couples, Wendy and Pat Kelly and Gretchen and Vernon Palmer, had scrambled to buy the derelict motel at an auction. They poured their talents and experience into reassembling an amazing motel. Interiors from old repurposed wood, sliding barn doors between the rooms of the suite, handmade coffee tables from the wood leftovers with locally welded table legs. We newly appreciated the artisanship after learning how welding was one of the emphasized, highly sought-after trades taught in the local community college. The owners beautified the parking spots with trees and planters, fire pits, and communal seating, and personalized the room interiors with old family photos. The WSS addressed head-on one of my travel pet peeves, a shortage of electrical outlets. We haul around a lot of electronic gear when we travel. Laptops, 3. iPads, 3. Cell phones, 2. Camera battery chargers, 2, and a portable ADS-B GPS receiver for the plane, plus countless adapters and cords. In most hotel rooms, if the outlets are not already fully occupied by lamps and clocks, they're hidden inaccessibly behind chests of drawers. But at WSS, the outlets were abundant and convenient. No more iPads propped up by the hairdryer. No more Sophie's Choice between our cell phones. Further, at WSS, there were no chunky telephones taking up real estate on bedside tables. Who even uses hotel phones these days anyway? There was plenty of low-voltage, eco-friendly lighting, plus a bright skylight over the shower, and lots of extra soundproofing blown into walls to make even passing trains sound romantic. And bikes to borrow. We stayed for about 3 weeks. Our weeks in Bend included more classic Americana, the activities you would try to show off to international visitors. We biked gentle trails, hiked along the rushing river, established favorite brew pubs and food stores among several, wandered the town museum, in particular, admiring its collection of pet cat photos, and walked in the parks where colorful hammocks hung in the trees. Why, I don't know. One fine day, we were stopped on a downtown sidewalk by the mascot for the Bend Elks, the collegiate summer West Coast League baseball team. Vinny the Elk and his sidekick were handing out free tickets to the opening game against the Corvallis Knights, not to be missed. We had already been to games for the Duluth Huskies, part of the Northwoods League, and the Allentown Iron Pigs, the AAA farm team for the Phillies. The college players for both the Huskies and the Elks are put up by local families for the summer, broadening the loyal hometown fan base. Next to me in the bleachers, along the third baseline, was a young guy who worked at Enterprise Car Rental. He had himself played ball for his community college team, probably less than a decade ago. He said the players with professional aspirations found the summer league especially valuable as a chance to hone their skills with wooden bats, like in the majors, instead of the aluminum bats that college teams traditionally use. Exactly 1,073 people were on hand that night we were there. Families poured in with toddlers new to the game and their older siblings who lined up at the face painting booth and then roamed free around the stadium. Guys in Hawaiian shirts struck up conversations with aging hippies, and the policemen who casually watched the gates slapped high fives with old-timers they called by name as they entered or exited the stadium. During my walks along Wall Street from our hotel toward downtown, I would pass a small strip mall where one storefront had little signage but a leaf. After a while, it dawned on me that this was one of Bend's new legal marijuana dispensaries. One day, I stood outside debating with myself whether or not to enter. My inner dialogue went something like this. I should go in. What will I ask? It's reporting. Do I need some special language? I'm kind of afraid to go inside. I'll go in. So I did. Inside, the look was of a small clinic, pristine, organized, understated. A young woman asked politely if she could help me. I thought I should come clean with exactly why I was there, as a journalist, to understand the business. And, I added, I would like to talk with the owner. Hunter Neubauer, a co-founder and co-owner of Oregrown, has an entrepreneur's spirit and a story like so many we found in Fresno, Pittsburgh, Greenville, Duluth, Redlands, and so on. He had sold medical devices for 10 years, had felt hemmed in, and had gone after this opportunity. Knowledgeable, articulate, and politically astute, he started a political action committee and went to D.C. to learn and lobby about cannabis issues. Responsibly risk-taking as a young family man, he'd raised local and family investment funds in order to start his ventures with his business partner, Aviv Haddad. Neubauer showed me around the shop, which brands itself as a grower and retailer of highly controlled farm-to-table cannabis for medical and recreational use. The retail space reminded me of a specialty coffee shop. He described the different varieties and products from leaves to bars, which look like candy. He told me about some typical customers, a mom from Alabama whose daughter has seizures, guys with football injuries, lots of patients with MS or PTSD, cancer patients who want to distance themselves from traditional pharma drugs, athletes, recreational types. I was a bit skeptical about so many medical users, until I saw some of those customers come in as I was leaving. Oregrown has since prospered in a broad sweep of ways. In the last few years, Neubauer and Haddad have established an 84-acre farm, partnered with various companies for apparel, tripled the space of their shop, added 24 employees, won congratulations from their state representative as an anchor merchant in Bend, joined the board at the Bend Chamber of Commerce, and underwritten the Young Professionals Network programming, supported athletes, offered public events, and helped beautify city parks. When I replaced the word cannabis with software or coffee, nothing about the story of the successful startup and its entrepreneurial millennials seemed at all unusual. When you're driving, or even better, biking around Bend, you quickly notice the roundabouts, more than 24 of them, a progressive solution to the town's growing traffic volume. Replace the traditional stop signs or lights at intersections with roundabouts. There were lots of arguments for roundabouts. Safety. Cars drive more slowly. Accident opportunities are fewer and less severe. Pedestrians only ever have to look to the left. Efficiency. No stopping at red lights, even when no one else is around. Environmentally friendly. Less idling and stopping and starting means fewer pollutants. Swapping big concrete intersections with green circles produces more oxygen. Bend had to work out a few kinks, like how to move oversized emergency equipment through circles smoothly and easing hesitant or confused drivers into different navigation habits. The town also saw a chance to beautify the roundabouts with nature and art, specifically with sculptures in the middle of the roundabouts. The first was installed in 2001. This effort matched many examples we saw of functional art personalized for America's towns, park benches, bicycle racks, fountains, beautiful edible gardens, bridges, and retaining walls. For the Bend roundabouts, artists submitted their ideas, the library displayed the prototypes, and the public voted. An early installation in 2002, officially known as Rising Phoenix, didn't go so well. People weren't sure what it was, and called it the Flaming Chicken. But more followed, and people got used to the sculptures just like they got used to navigating roundabouts. Some liked them, some didn't. But the art became affectionate points of reference, as in, I live near the Flaming Chicken roundabout. As part of their research into the community's library use and needs, the administrators of the Deschutes Public Library System, which includes Bend, filmed several Q&A sessions with residents about the library. For Todd Dunkelberg, the director of the six-branch Deschutes Libraries, the results were a wake-up call about the library's visibility and the people's familiarity with it. People felt guilty about not knowing about their library, he admitted to me. That was the sentiment voiced by lots of librarians I met, who lamented that their libraries were the best-kept secret in town. This connection to community, the third sturdy leg of the stool besides technology and education, where libraries engage to serve the people, was foundational in the Bend Library. In 2010, Dunkelberg and the Deschutes librarians set out to do something about it. The librarians assumed new titles. They were now called community librarians, and headed out to embed themselves in local groups and organizations, carrying the message of the resourceful and activity-rich library. They also wanted to see how they might build partnerships for the good of the community. At first, Dunkelberg said, the librarians met with a puzzled reaction. Why are you here? But after a few years of listening, learning, sharing stories, and collaborating, people would see the librarians coming and ask them, how can we work with you? Bend was pulling a paragraph straight from Tocqueville's observations from his classic reporting trip around America. In Democracy in America, Tocqueville waxed on in astonishment at how many associations Americans made for anything and everything. Americans of all ages, all stations in life, and all types of dispositions are forever forming associations of 1,000 different types, religious, moral, serious, futile, very general and very limited, immensely large and very minute. As soon as several Americans have conceived a sentiment or an idea they want to produce before the world, they seek each other out, and when found, they unite. That is still true nearly 200 years later. By now, the library staff in Bend is represented in more than 60 community groups, from the Chamber of Commerce to the City Club and the Homeless Leadership Coalition. The library system made about 20 formal partnerships and countless informal ones. For example, working together with the library, AARP helps with tax assistance, and Goodwill teaches resume writing classes. In its diverse offerings, the Bend Library is one example of many. Across the country, libraries are figuring out ways to be relevant or interesting to their communities. There's a long list of the sorts of popular offerings you find nearly everywhere. Art exhibits, book clubs, author readings, computer classes, story hours. I've practiced yoga and sipped lattes in libraries all around the country. In Washington, D.C., I saw a good 75 people dancing the tango in the big entry hall of the library. Libraries offer citizenship classes, English language classes, and programs on car safety, self-defense, parenting, and even, as in Bend, fighting forest fires. Local lending is the most inventive program. In Denver, you can borrow hiking equipment and maps from the public libraries before heading out into the mountains. In Vermilion, Ohio, on Lake Erie, you can borrow a fishing pole from the kids' section. In Gardening Crazy Duluth, you can borrow seeds for your home plot, then replenish the supply when your crop yields. In Burlington, Vermont, I saw the summer season tools available for borrowing: hoes, rakes, shovels, and a barrel of tennis rackets. In the winter, these are swapped for snow shovels, which the librarian told me are popular with ambitious teenagers who borrow them on snowy weekends to earn some money clearing sidewalks. You can watch movies in the newly plush basement theater, the former vault of the former bank building that is now the Kansas City Public Library. During the Minnesota summer, you can paddle your boat out to the floating library raft in one of Minneapolis and St. Paul's many lakes and take your books home in a watertight bag. In many towns, local companies cooperate with the libraries, often in product-relevant ways. In Greenville, the French company Michelin sponsored an art competition, offering donated tire scraps to construct internationally themed creations. In Redlands, the library and the locally based software mapping company Esri partnered on a geography day. Sometimes libraries fix problems they notice. In Bend, when the older population felt disrupted by the usual flurry of activity from the younger library users, the librarians decided to open for an exclusive older patrons only early morning hour. Later, when the biggest volume of questions brought from users to librarians, because they are trusted, focused on meeting mortgages or paying rent, the library hired a social worker to train the staff in handling those sensitive, detailed conversations. Similarly, people seek out librarians, because they are trusted, for medical issues. In Charleston, West Virginia, librarians described this typical scenario. A man comes into the library, rolls up his sleeve, and says, pointing, "Hey, I've got this spot on my arm. What do you think? Could you help me figure out what it might be?" When Hurricane Sandy ravaged New Jersey, the libraries remained open for shelter. With Hurricane Harvey, the libraries in Houston were tweeting their openings within a few days, encouraging people to come by. When schools closed after riots in Ferguson, Missouri, and after the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, the library stayed open as a safe place for kids. In Erie, Pennsylvania, the location of the new Blasco Library in 1996 became symbolic as a statement that Erie was on the road to recovery and rebuilding, after the loss of thousands of jobs when the General Electric plant radically downsized. Town planners and developers took a chance and located the library along the derelict waterfront, which the library's then executive director, Mary Rennie, described as an area of feral cats, rats, and sludge. Building on the water was an expression of local pride and confidence in the town's nautical heritage on Lake Erie. The library became a roaring success. Today, when the replica of Oliver Hazard Perry's tall ship, the U.S. brig Niagara, victorious in the War of 1812, sails into its home port of Erie, the librarians use the loudspeaker to alert the folks inside the library to rush to the windows to see it docking.
As a doctor's son, I'm always embarrassed to be sick. We were taught as children to shake it off, or wait for nature's tincture of time to take care of nearly anything that was wrong. When I was in third or fourth grade, we were on a family trip to some park that had a Korean War fighter jet parked as a playground attraction. I was up in the cockpit when my dad called out, "Kids, it's time to go home." I told him I was afraid to jump all the way to the ground from where I was. He said it would be fine, and I jumped, and I landed hard, and started complaining that my leg hurt. "It'll be fine, just wait till tomorrow," he assured me. 3 days later, I was in the emergency room, where x-rays showed the two places where I'd snapped my ankle bones. For everyone other than his own family, my father was actually a renowned diagnostician and a beloved local doctor. So I was embarrassed to be sick in Bend. But sick I was, and through the weeks we spent there, while Deb was out doing interviews, I spent a lot of time in the motel, coughing and running a fever and feeling bad. Finally, getting over my ingrained ethic about the tincture of time, I went to a nearby urgent care outlet to see if I could get some high-test cough syrup, ideally with codeine, so I wouldn't compound my problems, and Deb's, by keeping us both up with my coughing through the night. The nurse at the center looked at me with suspicion as soon as I said the word codeine. At the time, the opioid epidemic was not nationwide news, but it was already a big problem in mainly white, long working-class Central Oregon, and I had unwittingly put myself in the suspect category. Eventually, they heard me cough enough and were convinced enough by whatever lung infection I had to give me both the codeine-infused nighttime cough syrup and a giant dose of antibiotics, so that by the time we were ready to leave town, I felt fine again. What I did manage to see in the town bore on what we had been learning about nearly every other place we'd visited, which was, how had it come back, and where was it on the cycle? The question may now seem irrelevant as applied to Bend, which by the time of our visit was already gaining a reputation like that of Portland or Santa Fe as a desirable and hip post-industrial woes city. But in the 1980s, Bend and its neighbors in Central Oregon were mainly timber industry towns. And when that business collapsed, because of overcutting from one perspective, because of newly strict environmental regulations from another, because of cyclical ups and downs in the housing industry by all accounts, Bend had for a while the highest unemployment rate in the country, worse than Midwestern and Appalachian areas that were enduring the more celebrated declines of their coal or steel or auto industries. The story of this region's travails was both plainer and more complicated than others we had seen and learned about. It's plainer in that it was one more stage of the decline of a natural resources economy. In that way, it was similar to what happened when the sardine canning industry disappeared from Eastport, Maine, or when coal and chemical businesses declined around Charleston, West Virginia, or when the enormous copper mine that was the main economic reason for being of Ajo, Arizona, was shut down. Or what could conceivably happen to California's Central Valley or other farming areas if historic droughts and record heat continue. In central Oregon, the crucial natural resource was, of course, trees. Timber from privately owned tracts, as well as, significantly, the National Forest managed by the U.S. Forest Service and other federal lands run by the Bureau of Land Management. Loggers were in the forests, lumber workers were in the sawmills, truckers were behind the wheels of big rigs taking logs and boards to their destinations, and construction workers were on the job around the country putting wood products to use. It could not last. The trees ran out. The Forest Service changed its rules. The Endangered Species Act kicked in. And because of other factors, the timber and lumber industry that had built the communities, created great fortunes, and employed most of the working people in Bend, Prineville, and elsewhere would not regain its former scale. In its modern history, even Bend, now the largest, most prosperous, and most stylish of the cities in the area, had two episodes of severe downturn. One was in the 1980s, when it became clear that the timber industry really was gone and was not coming back. For America as a whole, the job losses after the financial crisis of 2008 were more severe than anything since the 1930s. It was different in Oregon, where the prolonged downturn of the 1980s had been even worse. For most of the country, the post-2008 recession differed from others in that so many jobs vanished and that they took so long to return. But for Oregon, the job losses had been even greater and the recovery even slower in the early 1980s. Then, unemployment in Bend and its surrounding counties was over 16%, according to state and federal employment statistics, when the national rate was nearing its recession-era peak of just under 11%. The same pattern occurred in 2009 and 2010, when the national unemployment rate briefly exceeded 10%, and that of Central Oregon neared 20%. This is not to minimize the impact of the post-2008 crash on Bend and its environs. This was one of several areas of the country, mainly in the Sun Belt, that had been riding a construction-born boom. When that boom ended, unemployment was as bad in Bend as in any Rust Belt trouble spot you could name. Bend suffered very badly during that crash because it was so real estate dependent, Denise Costa, managing editor of the Bend Bulletin, told us. Her husband, John, is the publisher. You would expect a city like this to have about 7% of its economy in real estate. Ours was about 20%, and it all went away. A New York Times feature in 2009 presented Bend in economic freefall. It said the city was a succinct symbol for the economic perils of lifestyle destinations in the so-called New West, recreation-heavy communities where jobs have been heavily tilted towards construction and services, and where many of the new residents were self-made exiles from California, cashing in on their overpriced real estate. 6 years later, a variety of small businesses had started up locally or moved from higher-cost cities. A tourism, resort, and retirement industry gained strength, along with a medical treatment and research complex, and their success restarted the construction industry. The real estate vacancy rate was around 1%. The city had two thriving-looking downtowns, the traditional-style one on Bond and Wall Streets, with strictly local outlets and an ever-growing array of craft brew operations anchored by Deschutes Brewery, and the restored Old Mill District with a 16-screen movie theater and hotels and national brand outlets and a Riverwalk recreation area where the mill ponds used to be. The main local concern of the moment seemed to be managing the pace of growth, both in the short term so as to avoid a repeat of the previous real estate bubble and bust, and in the longer run, to steer clear of a prospect that was always described to us as becoming another Aspen. By this, people meant a Mountain West shorthand for what could also be called another Hamptons or another Nantucket, a place so successful in attracting moneyed residents that the people who work for them can't afford to live anywhere nearby. Bill Smith, a developer who led the effort to convert the deserted lumber mill into the Old Mill Dining and Retail District, and his wife Trish, who has led the local public broadcasting board, the community foundation, the hospital and environmental boards, and similar civic causes, were the first people most Bend residents named when we asked our usual question, who makes things go in this town? When I asked Trish Smith what she thought first-time visitors might miss or misunderstand about the town, she said, it's easy to miss the depth of this community. Visitors would arrive, she said, and enjoy the fishing or the snowboarding or the beer. It is a hotly contested title, but by many accounts, Central Oregon has become the craft brewing capital of North America. And they don't realize that it's a place of substance, with libraries and parks and churches and the connections that give a community character. What went in the right direction for Central Oregon? Here are several answers. In one immediately obvious way, the Central Oregon story differed from other regional comeback sagas we've seen. The difference was in its educational establishment. There's no research university or even a four-year degree-granting university in Bend, Prineville, Redmond, or elsewhere in Central Oregon. This is an anomaly, because where you have tech-based hopes for economic growth, you almost always have a research university. The Golden Triangle of Mississippi has its challenges and successes, but it also has Mississippi State. Sioux Falls, South Dakota has a raft of private and public institutions. The Allentown-Bethlehem-Easton Triangle of Pennsylvania has been buoyed by Lehigh University, Muhlenberg College, and others. Greenville, South Carolina has nearby Clemson and in-town Furman and Bob Jones. And this is before we even get to Columbus, Ohio, with Ohio State, or Pittsburgh, with Carnegie Mellon and Pitt. It's an anomaly that people in Central Oregon are hyper-aware of, and it is part of a years-long local push to expand a branch of Oregon State University Cascades into a standalone four-year school in Bend. The proposed location for the new campus has been the subject of lawsuits and local controversy, but most people we spoke with expected that sooner or later the school will be built. The region has gotten along without a university, in significant part through an unusually active and ambitious community college, whose vice president told us that it was university-esque. Central Oregon Community College, or COCC, has its main campus in Bend, and branches in Redmond, Prineville, and elsewhere in the region. Like other community colleges, it emphasizes an extra chance for people who can't afford a four-year college, or aren't ready for it, or are busy with children, or have other things going on in their lives. It is also like them in working closely with regional employers and entrepreneurs. In 2013, for instance, the FAA approved sites in Oregon for tests of new UAV drone systems. Matt McCoy, the COCC Vice President for Administration and the man who said university-esque, told us that within a year, the college had a UAV technology program planned, staffed, and running. The healthcare industry is a major employer in Bend, and COCC has opened new health technology programs. Its branch campus in Redmond specializes in advanced technology manufacturing systems. But COCC was also different from other community colleges we've seen in ways that show the malleability of this educational model and that indicate how an institution responds when it's bearing normal community college responsibilities and stretching to do more as well. For instance, COCC is the oldest community college in Oregon, founded in 1949, and one that has been exceptionally stable. It has had only five presidents in its 65-plus years of existence. Faculty and staff members, once recruited, tend to stay. It has exceptional support from its community, including financial support. A local family donated the spectacular tract of land on Aubrey Butte, where the main campus is now located. Since 1955, local donors have supported the COCC Foundation, which gives out more than $1 million a year in scholarships. Usually, four-year schools crowd out community colleges for naming gifts, the large-scale contributions for buildings or scholarships named for the donor. COCC has done well with them. In 2009, during the worst of the recession, voters approved a big new bond for COCC. The resulting construction put hundreds of local people to work. COCC has created what looks like a campus, even though it is mainly a commuter school. Its setting is spectacular, nestled among evergreens with hilly paths, big playing fields, and open, inviting dining spaces. A new 330-bed dormitory would be opening in the fall after our visit, part of a movement of community colleges to attract some out-of-region students by offering dorms. We toured the new dorm space, still under construction. It seemed to us to have a state-of-the-art design, with a number of different rooming configurations to choose from. Administrator Matt McCoy, who had been at COCC for 17 years, told us, "When we say we are a community college, we really mean that we are for and of this community." Deb and I saw students doing a practice assembly the day before their graduation, and they indeed looked like a cross-section of people seeking a second chance or better opportunities. Their ages appeared to range from the early 20s through the mid-60s. There were more women than men, some young families with children, and some soon-to-be grads in construction company or service work uniforms from their day jobs. We noticed a less white, more racially diverse mix than in the town as a whole. "We feel," McCoy said, "an obligation to help it toward a future of equitable, balanced growth." Yes, you can hear this sort of thing anywhere. But as in several other communities that had a productive and respectful relationship with their community college, we got the feeling in Bend that this was more than just talk. Central Oregon's community college also played a role in Bend's evolution as a tech and startup locale. With its history as a resort town, skiing at nearby Mount Bachelor in the winter, rafting on the Rogue River and hiking and bicycling in the summer, Bend may be a more obvious place than Redlands to come to the notice of high-end investors. But startup companies didn't get there automatically, especially in the absence of a university complex or any long heritage of knowledge-intensive as opposed to natural resources businesses. I talked in Bend with a Silicon Valley veteran named Dino Vendetti, who moved to Bend full-time in the early 2010s, much in the fashion of the Bitwise team in Fresno or the Iron Yards in South Carolina's upstate region, has tried to foster a self-supporting high-tech community there. Vendetti, who is in his 50s and has combed back gray hair, would look at home as a veteran voice of experience at most venture capital conferences in Seattle or San Francisco. He grew up in Alaska, the son of immigrants, spent the early years of his career with Qualcomm, the globally dominant designer of chips for smartphones, which is based in San Diego, and then moved into the venture capital industry with Paul Allen's Vulcan Ventures in Seattle. He was successful enough that he bought a vacation home in Bend and began making regular visits there in the early 2000s. "I always knew that I wasn't going to spend the next 20 years of my life in the Bay Area with its hassle, or Seattle with its rain," he told me in the office of his Seven Peaks Tech Incubator in Bend. "I wanted to be someplace with actually interesting people, and I'd assumed that meant near a university, which Bend did not have." Vendetti was still based in Silicon Valley when the financial crash of 2008 affected businesses there as it did around the globe. As he observed the changes in business, technology, and culture, the growing caution of investors everywhere, the survival of the lowest cost and most adaptable new enterprises, the ever-increasing power of cloud-based computing, he decided that the right next step for him was to move his home and business to Central Oregon and see what he could accomplish there. Vendetti gave me a long description of the challenges a second-tier tech center, or even a no-tier tech location, as Bend was in those days, faced in creating a sustainable modern business environment. Without a nearby university, the most academically ambitious students would head elsewhere after high school, and not many would return. Without an established local investment or tech talent community, local startups that did get going would eventually leave for San Francisco, Seattle, or another metropolis. The more I got to know the Oregon market, he said, the more I realized that just as startups were getting to scale, the big venture funds would pull them down to the Bay Area, especially if they wanted to go public. This had a perpetual lopping-off effect on the local economy, and it meant that there wasn't a generation of successful business people in their 40s and 50s to encourage those in their 20s and 30s. Vendetti began running a local investment fund by himself, investing in software and medical technology startups in Bend and Portland. He helped to develop a computer science major at the new Oregon State University campus. He evangelized for Bend Enterprises on visits to established tech centers. He began arguing that the very absence of big technology companies gave Bend entrepreneurs an advantage, much as Greenville's history of many small textile firms, in contrast to the one big Millikan mill of neighboring Spartanburg, proved to make Greenville more agile and adaptable when the U.S. textile business plummeted a generation ago. If we'd had one dominant tech employer, like a big printer division for HP, I think we would be less entrepreneurial now, he said. HP would have hired up the talent as it arose. Instead, we've had a lot of smaller ones beginning to grow. We're kind of like a grape vineyard. You starve the plants for water, they have to send the roots deeper. By the time we talked in 2015, the general rise in the Bend economy included some 45 software and infotech-related businesses, plus 25 in medical technology, and a similar number in aerospace-related businesses. More important, Vendetti said, was a change in individual and company choices. People who had left the area were returning or giving interested looks. Companies that were being priced out of bigger cities were considering moves to Bend as well. There's always been some organic flow of talent into Bend because it's one of those places where people want to live, he said. But it's shifting and accelerating. As the Oregon market is maturing and things are getting ridiculously crazy in the Bay Area and Seattle, the costs, the complexity, the headaches of living there are at an all-time high. Silicon Valley can be an amazing place for your career during some phase of your life, but then as people begin to raise a family, places like Bend become ridiculously attractive. Vendetti was not suggesting that the concentrated role of the big global centers would go away. It was not an either-or case he was making, but an and, that people would choose to do some work in Bend, or Fresno, or Sioux Falls, as well as in New York, or San Francisco, or Los Angeles. I don't think there will be any mass exodus out of Silicon Valley, he said. But the disadvantages of not being there are diminishing. Partly that stemmed from the ability to hold on to talent. While big bonuses were luring engineers from Google to Facebook to Uber, as they did a generation before, from Intel to HP to Silicon Graphics, people who signed on with a regional company tended to stay there. Vendetti is, admittedly, a booster. And at the end of our talk, I asked him a but-seriously-now question. Were developments like those he saw in Bend part of any significant change in the regional distribution of opportunity? Or were they really just signs of a single town that had become lifestyle chic? No one can be sure, he said, but my sense is we're seeing a genuine shift. Historically, young people in early or mid-career just didn't have job opportunities in regional markets like this one. So the motivated ones just had to stay in the major metros. But there's nothing like two major recessions in a decade, the serious collapse of tech businesses in 2001 and the world crisis beginning in 2008, to have people reassess what really matters. He said, it's not a tidal wave, but a shift. I see people literally every week who want to find out about coming to bed for these life change reasons. Usually it's because they're tired of being on the hamster wheel or want to build a family. Vendetti argued that fostering the spread of tech companies to places like Bend served a larger national interest as well. Infotech and its related capacities are no longer a self-contained industry, he said. Anyone who tries to do anything, anywhere, is affected by their development. So it's crucial that communities across the country be able to participate in the tech economy in a more meaningful way. The tech industry needed to do this as a whole, he said, and he felt he was doing his best to do his part in Central Oregon. Bend and the surrounding parts of Deschutes County still have economic challenges. But the problems of a fast-growth era, from gentrification to ever more visible economic extremes, are preferable to what they replaced, which were the challenges of a sinking economic ship. The contrast becomes clearer as soon as you visit some of Bend's neighbors, like the small towns of Prineville and Redmond, which are still more heavily affected by the generations-long timber industry collapse. Redmond and Prineville, Oregon. Central Oregon as a whole had struggled since the fall of Big Timber. We visited two more towns in the region, Redmond, which is emerging as an aerospace center, and Prineville, which has cast its lot with the distinctively modern industry of running data centers. The Redmond story is again one about the incidental effects of personal decisions. When the Klapmeyer brothers were working in a barn in Wisconsin to design what ultimately became the very successful Cirrus airplane, their West Coast counterpart, contemporary, and competitor was a man named Lance Niebauer. Niebauer, who, when I met him in the 1990s, had thick, dark hair and a wide mustache of the kind sometimes called a pornstache, was designing a plane that was meant to be a Ferrari or an Alfa Romeo in relationship to the Audi or BMW the Klapmeyers were trying to provide. That is, the Midwestern brothers were trying to create a product that would be safe, comfortable, and nicely finished. Lance Niebauer, on the West Coast, with a company named after himself called Lance Air, wanted to build a plane that was fast. The first Lance Air models came to market at about the same time the first Cirruses did. For a combination of reasons, luck, the appeal of the Cirrus parachute, the more cramped test pilot-style cockpit of the much faster Lance Air, and, if not exactly luck again, good fortune when the Chinese government decided to invest in Cirrus, the Klapmeyer's company made its way through the financial crises of 2001 and 2008 much better than Lance Air did. Niebauer's company became a subsidiary of Cessna. Its models were renamed the Columbia, and it stayed in business with a production rate roughly one-tenth that of Cirrus. But much as the Klapmeyer's decision to move to Duluth became the basis for an aerospace complex there, and Jack and Laura Dangermond's decision to move from Cambridge back to Redlands transformed their hometown, so the partial success of Lance Air helped to make Redmond, the original base of the company, the site for further startups. Engineers and designers in Redmond already had experience with aircraft. The necessary machinery was on hand in local workshops. and people in the industry were familiar with Redmond from their calls on Lance Air during its most ambitious era. As a result, by the time of our visit, a cluster of small aviation companies had developed near Redmond's airport, including Stratos Aircraft, which employed several dozen designers and engineers working on the Stratos 714, a very light personal jet that would fill a then-tempting niche in the travel market. Corporate jets from Gulfstream or Hawker or Cessna were fast but cost tens of millions of dollars. Small personal planes like the Cirrus were much less expensive, but much slower and more exposed to the vagaries of weather, because jets can fly above most bad weather, while most propeller planes have to chug along at lower altitudes right through it. A very small jet, essentially like our Cirrus, but pressurized so it could fly high, and with a jet engine so it could fly far and fast, would be in the middle. Cirrus was also working hard on exactly such a project with the Vision Jet, which Chinese financing allowed it to build, and which it introduced in 2015. "We think we'll be successful here," Karsten Sunden, who is originally from Norway and is now Stratos' chief technology officer, told me. "We think we can go 50% faster and 50% further than the competitive airplanes." Private aviation is a notoriously risky market, not just for pilots and passengers, but for entrepreneurs as well. Sunden told me that the company believed it could be sustainably profitable by selling 25 planes per year, which would mean capturing about 10% of the relevant world market. The interesting aspect to me was why this company, along with suppliers and other related firms, ended up where it was. Sunden said, "Lance Air and its descendants are connected in one way or another with all the aerospace activity around here." Sunden himself, after starting out in Norway and spending his grade school years in Malaysia, had come to the United States in high school as an exchange student to Roswell, New Mexico, and learned to fly there. His interest in aviation brought him up to Redmond to meet with Lance Niebauer. He ended up liking the area and leapt at the chance to join Stratos when it started in 2008. On my way out of Redmond, after touring the facility and sitting in a mock-up of the new plane, I saw a bumper sticker that concisely summed up the locational theory I had heard from the likes of Dino Vendetti and Karsten Sunden. "Veni, vidi, velcro," the sticker said. "I came, I saw, I stuck." Primeville is by far the hardest hit of these three cities. In its heyday, Primeville had been a very profitable timber center. But like many other cities in the region, it had seen that business collapse. The other mainstay of the local economy had been the headquarters of the Les Schwab tire chain, which had spread to hundreds of locations across the western United States from its founding location in Primeville. A laudatory article about the company in Tire Business magazine in 1995 pointed out that in a city whose population was only 5,000, some 600 people worked directly for Les Schwab. But in 2008, just as the national economy was in post-crash freefall, the company moved its headquarters to Bend, eliminating hundreds of jobs. In Primeville, I spoke with John Schelk, a leader of the lumber industry in its heyday, and now someone trying to imagine a future for the business and his town. When we met, he was in his 70s, standing erect and with abundant white hair. We met at the modest offices of Ochoco Lumber, which was founded in the 1930s and of which his family had long been majority owner. In the decades after World War II, the Ochoco Mills employed hundreds of foresters, sawyers, and other high-wage workers in its plants. The trees that they cut, barked, and fashioned into timber to ship around the country and the world came from the nearby Deschutes and Ochoco National Forests, which the U.S. Forest Service had opened to commercial lumbering operations in the late 1940s. The industry collapse that affected the rest of the region affected Ochoco as well. By 2001, its sawmill closed for good. At the time, the mill still employed some 250 people, almost none of whom would ever find logging work again. Too many of the larger trees were gone. The environmental rules and standards had changed. Such work as was left was more mechanized with fewer employees. When we were developing our markets, especially in Japan, we assumed that the harvest from the national forest would inevitably decline, Schelk said, but we never imagined that it would go immediately to zero, which was how he viewed the consequences of the new restrictions placed on loggers during the Clinton administration. The Clinton-era plans, he told me, effectively eliminated commercial timber harvest on these forests, thereby dooming the remaining sawmills in Central Oregon. After World War II, nearly a quarter of Oregon's entire economy was based on forestry. Now it's barely 2%. This is the Pacific Northwest counterpart to the saga of Appalachian coal. In recent years, as a senior statesman of the timber industry, Schelk has worked with environmental and scientific groups, state and federal regulators, and both Republican and Democratic politicians, notably Oregon's Democratic U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, to devise a sustainable harvest plan to revive at least part of the region's forest-based economy. Schelk drove me around the ruins of what had been his family's factory. Many of the buildings remained only as deserted hulks. Some had been bulldozed into clear lots. On the site of one, a new hospital now stood. "Of everything I see here, that's the one I feel good about," he told me. A mile or two away were the vast warehouse-scale structures that were part of Prineville's next economic hope. These were data centers for Facebook and Apple, totaling well over $1 billion in investment costs and millions of square feet of space. The companies were drawn to the region by its low electric power rates and its steady, cooling wind, along with property tax exemptions. Facebook cast itself as an active member of the community, opening its building for tours and for school group events. Apple operated behind a wall of secrecy. No tours, no identifying sign or flag outside its buildings, no encouragement for local contractors or employees to say anything in public about their jobs or even where they worked. We spent a day inside the Facebook site, which is mainly endless corridors of computers and cabling, and looked at Apple's only from the roadway and from above when we flew out of town. Together, the firms represented this region's entry into the highly automated next economy, much greater capital investment than the old tire and timber facilities, comparatively fewer jobs. Building the new data centers creates hundreds of construction jobs in town. Operating them requires many fewer people. Still, it was progress. "We're celebrating here at the city," Steve Forster, the city manager of Prineville, told The Oregonian after Facebook announced another expansion in 2017. The county's unemployment level had fallen from a catastrophic 20% in the late 2000s to around 6.5%, much worse than the national average, much better than it had been. "That's what this is about," he said.
Chester, Montana. We headed north from Bend toward Walla Walla and on to the paired towns of Clarkston and Lewiston in Washington and Idaho. The towns were named for those intrepid travelers, William Clark and Meriwether Lewis, whom we'd thought about often since landing near their route in South Dakota and again now along the Snake River. Flying low over Chief Timothy Park, on an island near the confluence of the Snake and Clearwater Rivers, we peered down toward the nearly finished art installation by Maya Lin, the designer of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. The installation is part of a project called Confluence, which memorializes six Lewis and Clark sites along the Columbia River system. This one was a Nez Perce-inspired modern hieroglyph, something she called a listening circle, Large partial circles of stone rimmed a natural amphitheater and nestled into a grand landscape that had barely changed since Lewis and Clark paddled through there. This destination fit into the most noble of three practices we had adopted during our travels. On the low culture end, we typically landed from our